very briefly say, we've been defining an ethical issue as any course of action affecting human well-being. And you'll see how this plays out a little bit, but that's what our definition of ethical issue has been. And morality, connected with that, has been anything that deals with choices of behavior which are right or wrong. We've been talking about this as the question of oughtness. Ought I to do this or ought not I to do this, based on is it right or is it wrong, and therefore do I have a duty or an obligation to do it or refrain from doing it. Ethics itself is the next step of looking at the systematic formulation of moral principles, rules, and standards that help guide us in questions of morality. What principles guide us in making these decisions about whether or not I ought to do something? And then for the sake of what we're going to do here, an ethical dilemma is any time some of these values or commitments that we have made come in conflict, and we have to choose between one or more of these two values or more that are in conflict. The rest of these are things that you might find helpful to read over just in terms of definitions about values, rights, duties, and so forth. We won't spend much more time on that now. Now, out of that, then, we listed a series of basic ethical principles that are rooted primarily in the first one here, that is, ethics assumes a respect for all persons based on the intrinsic value of all persons. And then the rest of these principles are ones that most of us are familiar with, maybe not necessarily by the names here, such as non-maleficence, which is the principle, do not intentionally inflict harm on an innocent person. But these are some of the different principles we're going to ask you to make reference to during the case study. Chances are, if this is your first visit to this series, you'll be in a small group with other people who've been through this and can help you with this part of it. I'll jump back over to one other very quick difference here. We talked about different approaches, or different ethical approaches, basically around two poles of behavior. The first one, what we're calling the absolutist or the deontological model, which means you pay attention to the means that are involved in making ethical decisions. By this I mean you pay attention to the obligations and duties that should govern behavior, such rules as never steal, always tell the truth, those kinds of things, and those are what are emphasized in making decision making. It tends to emphasize the individual. When there's a conflict between what's good for society and what's good for the individual, an absolutist will tend to resolve it in favor of the individual. The other side of that is what we've been calling the consequentialist or the ends-oriented means, which pays attention to the probable outcome of different alternatives. You examine the consequences of any of the choices you make and then weigh those consequences against each other in order to make your decision. Consequentialists tend to emphasize the maximizing human welfare or the community. One way of remembering it is the principle of utility, which is the greatest good for the greatest number. And then we've also talked about the fact that many of us will work out of both of these or a mixed or a contextual approach. Sometimes we follow an absolutist kind of thing, such as always respecting confidentiality. Other times we will follow a consequentialist one, such as weighing the probable burdens versus benefits of a particular course of action. And what we're going to pay attention to today when we debrief our scenarios and ask you to do some of this in your small groups is just be aware of how you're operating. Now, the last thing I'm going to say here before just briefly going to the model is that the deontological, which I have a red star here, or these absolutist ones, represents the first seven basic ethical principles there. Those are basic principles that are considered inviolable regardless of the consequences. So you don't worry about consequences. Things like honesty, fidelity, justice, non-maleficence are considered to stand by themselves regardless of consequence. The last three, which have a green mark around them, the green star here, are consequentialists. That is, those are principles that take into consideration what are the likely consequences. So beneficence, which is aims at promoting the whole well-being of people, you must take into consideration what the consequences are in order to obey this principle here. The last thing is just the model that we're going to be working through again today is basically a two-step model. The first three steps in the first section are what we are involved in analyzing the situation. These involve gathering relevant information, identifying what issues, what's the dilemma, which of these principles are in conflict, and then beginning to generate alternatives and examine those consequences. The second half of this model is the area of moral assessment. Once you have identified the ethical issues that are in conflict and how the different alternatives and consequences play out, then you go through a process of assessing them in terms of their ethical importance. Assessing alternatives and consequences, assessing the underlying motives behind each one, and then finally having to choose one of your alternatives and being prepared to justify why you made that choice in terms of the ethical principles that are respected versus the ones that are violated. So that's a very brief overview. We'll come back to that as we introduce the case, but just wanted to get everybody on board on that. The last thing I'll say again is that we introduce these as a means of helping us to talk together. If you find them confusing, just go on your own instincts. You're probably just as well on that. But this, when we debrief it, we'll be making reference to this so we have a way of comparing what we're saying about these things.
Okay, when we do our last of this series on Saturday morning, I think what we're going to do is ask one of you who's been to every one of them to do this little brief overview. That'd be good?
No, you're in class final exam.
That's right. Yeah, teaching at St. Olaf, that's probably what I do. Now, those of you who've been here, why don't you explain something to those of you? That'd be good teaching. By way of a fairly brief introduction to the topic today on organ transplantation, I just want to make a few comments. First, however, ask a few questions. How many in this room, by a show of hands, have considered donating or plan to donate organs after your death? Lots of folks. Okay. Has anybody here been a recipient of an organ donation at this point? Or anybody have a family member as a recipient? Okay. Okay. Anybody work in organ transplantation? Please be honest if you do. Procurement nurses or transplant surgeons in the audience, it would be helpful for us to use that expertise. Anybody been a recipient yourself? Probably not. Raise your hand for those. Okay. Anybody here from Oregon? A couple people? Okay. I guess that was my question. Good. Let's just talk about three, four brief issues I want you to keep in mind as we're going through the case study today. One is that the United States leads the world, and the Western world particularly, with the amount of our gross national product that's spent on healthcare resources. That is 12% as compared to most Western European countries or Great Britain, Germany. Many of those hover around 9%, 9 to 10%. And in developing world nations, some of you may know better than I, but it's in the low percentages, 4, 5, 6%, something like that. So we really do devote a tremendous portion of our resources in this country to healthcare. There's also currently a very major debate going on in our country, which many of you, I think, are very well familiar with and will play a large part, I think, in our upcoming presidential election. And that is whether people in our country have the fundamental basic right to the best medical care available in the world. Is that a fundamental basic right for people in this country? To expand it, we might consider about whether healthcare is a basic right for people in the world. So it's sort of a two-part
at least in the United States.
Comment. I'm sorry?
Or at least in the United States.
Yeah. Well, I'm saying both. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, the U.S., because we have the best medical care in the world in many ways, highest technology, etc. And then what does that say about people's rights worldwide to a basic level of medical care? Fourth, to consider the question whether you think right now we ration healthcare in the United States. Some argument about that too, whether we do or do not, or whether we're going to have to at some point because of the direction our country is taking. I asked about Oregon because some of you are probably familiar with the stance the Oregon legislature has taken in determining 700 some categories of medical treatments and deciding which of those are going to be covered under their welfare or medical assistance program and which won't be. Although I read in yesterday's paper that the Bush administration, Health and Human Services Department, has said that they will not allow this waiver, they will not grant Oregon the right to do this experiment, which is essentially what it is, a social policy experiment. So Oregon has in many ways taken a stab at it, but I think probably isn't going to be allowed to go much further. And some of you may know more about that. Lastly, is to talk about briefly the cost of organ transplantation. Just the cost of an organ usually sits around $100,000, give or take thousands of dollars, depending on the organ and where you are in the country. The process of a transplantation from the time of procurement of the organ, used to be called harvesting of organs, procurement is the politically correct term, I think for some good reasons, through perhaps a year of follow-up thereabouts, again, give or take, depending on where you are in the country, what medical center, et cetera, is around $200,000 to $250,000 for transplantation of one organ. Again, it's a very rough estimate, but that gives you an idea sort of what to go with in terms of cost. So what we're talking about are some big questions about who gives organs, who gets organs, who pays for organ donations. So just a little food for thought as we get into the case study here.
Very good piece.
Yeah.
All right. We're going to follow, for those of you who've been here before, follow a similar kind of thing and have you break up into small groups for 20 to 25 minutes to talk together about this. We're going to do a little bit differently than we've done before in that the person on whom this case study is based is here today to talk to us. So after we've read the case, you'll have a chance to ask her some questions before you go into your own discussion. But what we'd like you to do right now is to break up into groups of 4 to 6 folks. I know it's getting harder to pick people that you don't know anymore since you've been mingling a lot, but try and be in a group where there are at least a couple faces that you're not as familiar with so we can cross this around. And we'll pass out the case to you at that point and read it over together. Let me read this case study and you can read along with me. Barbara was referred to the University of Minnesota Hospital for her first pancreas transplant in 1985. She was 36 years old, white, and had had insulin-dependent diabetes for 25 years. The pancreas transplant was advised because of the progressive nature of her diabetes complications. Barbara's insurance was through her husband's employment, a group plan through his union. Request for coverage was initially denied, but on appeal was approved, and she received a pancreas. During the following 2.5 years, she did extremely well, and her complications stabilized. Then, in 1988, she rejected the pancreas and became very ill. Barbara applied for a second pancreas transplant, again was denied coverage, but on appeal was granted approval. She underwent a second transplant in 1988. This transplant was not successful and the organ was removed several months later. Her diabetes progressed, her kidneys failed, and she began kidney dialysis, which continues at present. She and her husband are also now divorced. In 1992, Barbara requested a kidney transplant. She also asked for another pancreas transplant to be done simultaneously, but was denied both by her employer's insurance company. She then quit her job and was given Minnesota medical assistance, which initially granted coverage for both the transplants. However, before the operation could occur, Minnesota medical assistance dropped coverage for pancreas transplants. Thus, she is not eligible for coverage of a third pancreas transplant, but can get a kidney transplant. Without a new pancreas, however, the kidney transplant will not be helpful, and Barbara will be on dialysis until diabetes complications take her life. Okay. What we've been doing the last few case studies together is that we have been going through step one together, gathering the relevant facts and information, and Mary and I have provided you with those facts. We have a little bit different situation today, however, in that Barbara Jennings, mother of two children, is here today with us. And I'd like to introduce you to Barbara. And Barbara has agreed to give us about 5 minutes of her time for you to ask whatever questions you think are important as you consider her case before we go on to the discussion. So I introduce Barbara Jennings to you, and you can ask whatever questions you think are relevant that would give you more information in deciding this case ethically.
I'm kind of nervous to be here, but I'll give you whatever information you want. Dan said he might have to cut us off at some point if there's some information not relevant. But feel free to ask. It's my situation.
How difficult is it to match a pancreas, and what would it cost if you didn't have the insurance?
Well, the doctors tell me it's fairly easy to match pancreas compared to a lot of organs. Also, that pancreases are I guess, easier to come by than a lot of organs. So
are they cheaper?
They're somewhat cheaper. It would probably still cost me around $200,000 to get this third one.
How many people requested their first pancreas last year and were denied or accepted and never received a pancreas and then died?
I don't know. I really don't know. I had one friend in the hospital in Minnesota who requested one, didn't get one covered, and she died within about a year. But the doctors have given me 1 to 3 years. They don't know for sure how long my diabetes would hold out if I don't get another one, something like that.
What was the insurance company's reasoning for turning you down?
Well, they turned me down the first 2 times and then okayed it. And then I got divorced. And then my job had insurance that just said it was too expensive and it was a third time and they weren't going to do it.
Why did Minnesota Medical Assistance drop coverage for pancreas transplants?
Well, I've been calling people to find that out, and what I'm told is that Medicare has some guidelines about transplants, and one of them is that they usually cover kidneys for people over 65 or who are disabled and on Medicare. They sometimes cover liver and sometimes cover heart. They don't cover pancreas. And that a lot of states' welfare programs, the medical assistance programs, are adopting the Medicare guidelines just because it's handy and it's federal.
What's the cost of dialysis treatment for the rest of your life if you can't get the pancreas?
Oh boy, I don't think I've even asked that. So far, MA is covering that, but I want to say, I don't know, 50,000 a year, 40,000 a year, something like that. I don't know. Are there doctors here who might know more what dialysis costs me? I go in 3 times a week for 3 hours or so and get my kidney, my one good kidney, dialyzed.
Were you on a waiting list for either your first or second transplant? To your knowledge, were you moved up on the waiting list for your transplant?
Yeah, I was on one. I wasn't on it for real long. There seemed to have been enough when I needed it. From the first one, I waited a couple months, and the next one I waited about 5-6 months. So I know I was on a list. I don't know where the list is or how people move up.
Okay.
Really, I just know that I got
well,
what I need.
How do you feel about this situation?
Well, I have a couple kids, and I'm waiting to find out what's going to happen.
I mean, are you sort of angry? Or?
Well, I've been angry twice in a big way. At that time, I could afford a lawyer, and my lawyer did a good job with the insurance companies pushing them to cover it. This time, I'm not sure I'm going to have the stamina, really, to go through that kind of fight. I'm sort of sad about it, angry at some level, not as angry as the first 2 times. I guess I'm tired.
Is the fact that you had 2 pancreas rejections, ultimately, does that predispose you to have more probability of failure of a third pancreas transplant?
Yeah, I think it probably does at some level, though I haven't been given any sort of statistics of the likelihood that I'd reject this one. I guess I'm assuming there's some. Although I also don't think my doctor would okay a transplant, which he's done, if he didn't think it would give me a good period of time of life. I don't know how long.
Barbara, there's a question over here, and then we'll give just a couple of minutes.
Is it possible that the pancreas is more easily rejected than other organs?
I think that depends on the person, but it's a medical question. I don't really know. Yeah.
If you had the kidney transplant without the pancreas transplant, eventually that ruins the kidney, but how long does that take, and would that be a waiting period in which you could continue to fight for a new pancreas? And
yeah, as I understand it, that might give me some time. I don't know how much time, because my diabetes is pretty bad. I've had it since I was a real small kid. It's not the kind you get as an adult. Mm-hmm. And I know that my doctor said they'd rather just do it together. It saves time and money to do a combined transplant. But it would probably give me some time, months maybe, some months.
One last question here, and then we're going to have to say goodbye to Barbara.
Did you say how old your children were?
Yeah, my son's 11, my daughter's 6.
Maybe one last question on that line, Barbara. Did you get child support for the children since you're now divorced?
Well, he tries. He's unemployed right now because the factory he worked for in Minnesota was closed down, and so I probably get $500 a year.
Okay.
Not very much.
A year?
A year.
Okay, well, Barbara, thanks very much for being with us today. we are going to ask now that...
Oh, I decided to...
Who are we?
Three, two, three.
Are
we're going to tell you right now.
We're going to tell you who you are.
And should we just do it?
All right, we're going to hand out a little sheet for each of you that tells you who you are in this, and then we're going to tell you the questions we want you to consider.
Oh, yeah. Back to the large group again. Get the tape started rolling again. That's a tape, guys, so we're going to wait just 30 seconds while it just goes up. Turns it back on. Okay, what I'd like to do is do a quick polling of the group to answer one question. Whether you said yes, she should get it, or no, she shouldn't. That's it. Yes or no on your group, all right? How about you?
Yes.
Yes?
Yes.
Yes?
Yes.
Yes?
No.
No?
Yes.
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 Yes?
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
Undecided.
Okay?
Yeah. Politician.
Quick polling here of the yeses. Of the yeses. I'm sorry, go ahead.
We don't function as a unit, so we don't have to decide. We're congregation.
I was going to say, are you the legislature, or the family, or the congregation? All of them could not function as a unit. Okay, for the yeses, I want to hear briefly, quickly answered, who's supposed to pay for it?
Insurance.
Us. Which insurance?
Yeah, MA.
Welfare. MA.
Minneapolis MA. Texas.
Okay, Minnesota MA.
The state.
The state, also. Same.
Charitable fund drive.
Charitable fund drive, the undecided's come up with. Okay?
Well, we were split. Some of us felt we should go through the insurance first, and then if that didn't work, then do the. Did we tell who we are?
Yeah.
Not yet.
Okay, that you should go through the insurance first, and then if that didn't work, then the family would get into it and do fundraising. Others of us felt that it was the family's responsibility at this point, and that they would be primary financially.
Okay, so we get some of each. Good.
She's not
no. Oh, you're the no, right.
The state should pay for it.
State should pay for it.
We figured that maybe the congregation can set up some kind of a fund and help in a minor way, but.
In a minor tune of $200,000 way, or just part of that?
Part of that.
Okay, you'll make your best effort. Okay, congregation?
State.
Okay.
So most folks felt that the state, some folks felt that there's some combination of family and the congregation could do charitable fund drive.
Okay, we'd like to see if one or two of the groups who were yes groups would be willing to share the process you came to. Ideally, we're going to have some sort of representative amount here. But we have three kinds of groups, probably figured out. Family members, immediate family members of Barbara's, Minnesota State Legislature, and the congregation that Barbara belongs to. So maybe a yes family group would start. Who was yes and family? And would you talk to us a little about what you thought through and what some of the issues were coming up? Yeah.
Well, I'm Barbara's mother, and we got together with the two sisters and the brother here and grandma.
The role play continues.
Her daughter didn't say anything at all. But anyway, we just felt that she wants this, and she's worked hard, and she deserves to get it, and we're really angry that the state isn't coming through. Now, we do know somebody else that needs a pancreas, too, so that came in a little bit, but we just feel like she really should get it. We can't desert her, and we're going to fight for her and hire a lawyer and try to get the state to.
Okay, and which of these fundamental principles do you think came into play here, Sam?
Did you see an ethical dilemma in this or not?
We did, and we know that she's just a special person to us, and we just cannot, we can't see the whole picture because it's too emotional for us.
So the dilemma that sort of exists out here is between your loved one and this person you know, and maybe other people who need a pancreas. Okay, and based on her being your loved one, it probably is talking about respect for persons, that she has intrinsic value, but for you, she has more intrinsic value, perhaps, than this person you know of. Is that accurate to say, as family members? Okay.
Any other principles that came into conflict for you in talking about it?
Well, yeah, we feel a little guilty because we don't think it's quite fair because of the cost and the utility, because we do know some other people that could use organs, and we're worried about this other man that we know that's been on the list for a long time to get him.
So possibly some conflict with greatest good for the greatest number, mm-hmm. possibly some conflict in terms of justice, in terms of equity. You know that by now we're talking 3 organ transplants for probably up to $700,000-$800,000 to maybe extend life 2 or 3 years, we don't know. So those are some of the things that conflict maybe with, but also feeling that this is your loved one.
Right.
And did you feel any differently, do you recall, when Barbara got denied the first time for her first transplant? Before it was approved, did you feel any differently since that was the first time she was asking for
Well, we did talk about her state of mind, and we said on some days she seems a little more accepting, and I think we felt like if she would accept not getting it, that we would feel differently. Mm-hmm. She was more gung-ho back then, so we were more gung-ho.
Okay. Would you talk to her at all about these utility questions?
Too frightened.
That's tough.
Another family group
want to talk? Both other family groups say yes? I think so.
And
yeah.
Either of you are significantly different than the others, or were there differences?
We had less discussion on a dilemma, although the one that was discussed was the same one, the benefit versus utility versus respect for persons. Yeah.
Okay. Any other parts of the issue come up to you, or any other considerations to talk about?
Well, I think that we had a slightly different color on that. We felt that the dilemma was that the family members were, I guess I didn't articulate it, but I'm thinking about it now, that there's a bit of dishonesty, there could be a bit of dishonesty if you felt strongly about the burden benefit argument, that you wouldn't be honest with your sister, say, and you would say fidelity and respect for dignity of life and so forth would overwhelm the feelings that you might privately have, and therefore you are in fact being dishonest. And that was a moral dilemma for you. And on the other hand, you felt duty bound as a family member. It didn't seem as if you would have any other choice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What I'm also hearing some of there too is that people were aware of the importance of motive when you're an immediate family member. I mean, the first group talked about we feel a little guilty because if this were just some other person, it'd be different, but she's not. She's our daughter, our mother, our sister, that kind of thing. So awareness of the motive is affecting the way you make the decision. And you're saying similar kind of thing too, feeling duty bound versus feeling completely honest.
Okay, third family group was where? Did you have any additional things here?
Well, we looked at it as the basic ethical principles were a matter of justice, but also non-maleficent. Is that how you say that? That by withholding it, it was doing a harm was one of our practices.
Okay.
Okay.
I heard somewhere in one of the family groups too some discussion about who's willing to take care of her children at some point. And it's part of the motive of her wanting to have this is that she keep living so that she could manage her children and that you didn't have to worry about that. Did I hear a little bit about so burden benefit to you, family also, and how much more?
All of us are unwilling to help her with her children.
I just want to point out one thing that so far, except for that last example there, and that has to do with motive as well. That did, but so far the people who favor giving yes are following an absolutist logic here of these inviolable, recognizing the dilemma with the consequentialist ones, utility and justice of the common good, but still following that. But interesting here too that you also brought in a consequentialist argument in terms of who gets the kids, a burden benefit for the family members on that as well. So, and having that also having to do with possibly motive, affecting motive.
Well, and that burden benefit thing is, you can continue a little further because if she gets a pancreas transplant, she therefore doesn't have to go on for dialysis, which is very costly.
Mm-hmm.
Plus,
the assistance for her children.
So burden and benefit can cut both ways.
Right.
Okay.
Good point, which is often the case. Now, should we go to state legislatures? We'd like to get a yes and a no. Maybe how about first the yeses? Who in the legislature thought she should get the transplant? Okay.
We talked about this, and obviously there is a certain amount of pressure that's been put upon the legislature by family members and possibly press and other things. This is an election year coming up, and we're a Democratic-leaning legislature, which means that we're more inclined to be pro-medical support and all these things. These all kind of got mixed up, but as politicians are, we're looking for an out. Okay, we're looking for an escape, and we've gone over the case very, very carefully now, and we've noticed that she made some deliberate attempts here to get medical attention for herself. One, that she quit her job and abandoned her insurance when her insurance company couldn't provide service for her so that she could get on state assistance. Now, perhaps there was an implicit promise that both of these transplants were available. It's not clear right now. We are taking it at the word of this poor woman that she was promised and made the applications as appropriate. Unfortunately, she got caught in a crunch, changing in the law, changing in funding. You know, the choice that the state has gone to minimize costs and fall back on the Medicare safety net regulations. We feel in this case that we need to make a special case for her, that the promise was made, she made the application, and to fund this particular transplant.
So you're not changing the state regulations to...
No,
we're doing an exemption.
The pressure has been so great.
A waiver in the state...
We want to look like good guys. We see an out. We see a loophole. We're going to take a good role.
So you're a bit consequentialist. You're looking for election results. Question of motive.
Not too far off, huh?
Yeah, and the fact is, many of you will be up for re-election in the fall, and if I don't get it, it's likely I could die before then.
That's correct.
Wouldn't the media do something?
We're not concerned about the fourth transplant, because that's another problem.
Would you say to her, this is it? Don't come back to us if it doesn't work.
We don't have to worry about it.
They just want to get rid of it. They just want to get rid of the issue,
right? Okay. Pretty shallow.
Okay. You did talk about the fourth possibility?
We did talk about that a little bit. And maybe after three pancreases, if the third one was rejected, that the dilemma would be burden benefit, you know, versus, we're talking about money, and if a third pancreas didn't work, then what was the probability that a fourth wouldn't either, so. Mm-hmm.
You're also talking about all of our money. You're talking about our taxpayer dollars here, so your own money and the family's money and my money, and not my money anymore as Barbara, but mine as Mary, perhaps. So you are the stewards of a lot of people's resources for a lot of needs, and it becomes a much bigger issue in this utility or consequentialist perspective when you're saying, now where are we going to put our resources, our dollars, for the good of humanity here?
And just point out again that as opposed to most of the family groups, you follow the consequentialist approach, considering the way you're spending the state's money, maximizing things, but also, and this is, we're moving in the area of political ethics as well, you are using a consequentialist analysis from your own motive in terms of election. You know, what's the likely outcome for us, not just Barbara, not just the state, but for us as legislators. So you can see how biomedical ethics quickly involves political ethics as well when it gets into the political system.
Okay, let's go quickly to the no's so we have some time here. No for the state legislature, right?
No,
we said yes.
I'm sorry.
Yes.
Over here, sorry.
Who was the no? And you are who?
We're the legislature.
Your legislature, too. Yeah, what was some of your process? What came up for the...
I think we went through a lot of the similar, you know, thought processes that everybody went through. The respect for dignity of life of an individual, and then the burden benefit. And we didn't just think of passing up one individual for, you know, like giving her this $200,000 treatment would... free up or would stop somebody else from getting it. We thought of inoculations for, you know, mm-hmm. 500 individuals. I mean, it's not like it was just, this money would just go to somebody else needing a pancreas transplant. It could help thousands of school children. I mean, it could do a variety of different things.
So you brought up the whole debate of preventative mm-hmm. healthcare versus curative healthcare as
yeah,
part
just,
of this.
Just that there's a lot of ways this money could be spent, okay. Not just on a pancreas. I guess we also felt like we needed more information on what the likelihood was of her accepting this organ. It sounded like it was pretty unlikely. And also the cost then of estimating her life and the cost of dialysis treatment until she were to die. So really looking at the cost outweighing, even though it sounds sick, but kind of outweighing the cost. And I would say we didn't all agree on this no decision.
I think it was the fact that it was her third transplant. Mm-hmm.
Okay, that made some difference. Right. Yeah. And if I slipped into Barbara again, she would probably say, you know, if I get it and it's successful, I can go back to work and I'll be a functioning, productive member of society.
And
the state wouldn't have to take care of my kids. And yeah, wouldn't be doing my dialysis, wouldn't have to pay for a nursing home if I don't die fast enough, so the hospital keeps me in there, that kind of stuff. Okay, anything different of the other yes group?
Well, they haven't had a congregation yet. So
I know, anything different, fast?
Just fast is we're not going to get reelected, and we believe that we're going to get run out of the state, probably.
There you go.
We believe that life is a healthcare is a fundamental right of the individuals of our constituents, and we'd like to set a precedent. And we're currently writing a bill for socialized medicine.
Okay, good.
Unlimited cost.
Unlimited cost, that's right. Okay.
We're all over 75, too.
So. We have debated how to bring the race concern in here also, and ethnicity, because there are some major debates in transplantation about who's getting organs and who's not, partly who's insured and who isn't, but partly what race and ethnicity people are.
What about sex? We brought that up. Would it be any different if it was a male?
Yeah, there's been some issue there too, yeah. Can we go to the congregation first, and if we have time, we'll come back to some of those. We had, how many, two congregations? Both yes, right? Would you be willing to share a little of your process here? Which of the principles maybe came into play, or what the dilemma was?
Well, we kind of looked at it in a pessimistic way. We said, well,
what kind of congregation are
children, right? But another way we looked at it was maybe a cop out. You know, we do have many people here from different parts of the city. Maybe there's someone here who is a doctor and who knows someone who's a pancreas specialist in Houston who can, you know, procure an organ for her at a very cheap indigent rate.
This is how people think in congregations. Okay, this is good.
Get a cheap one.
Another guy.
Just
for the sake of everyone, when I went over there, they had already given up on Barbara. We're planning her funeral. So this is an interesting congregation.
Well, and you know, the issue becomes whether if you're an inner city congregation that's fairly poor and sees the result of lack of insurance and poverty that hits many cities or real rural areas, you may have a different sort of perspective or bent on whether somebody should have a third transplant costing another $200,000.
Yeah, we were asking ourselves, what kind of a congregation are we? Are we one of a bunch of young activists who really be vocal about it? Or are we ones who just generally say,
Yeah. Well, praying is a big one. That's something you do as a congregation. Okay. Should we go to the last congregation?
Yeah.
Okay. Where's the last other congregation? Oh, up there. Sorry. Undecided.
The majority was against trying to raise the money as a congregation, but there were people who decided they would try to start some sort of charity drive, and they. Major things that we came up with were the cost benefit just in general, and the arguments against that were that our kids, you know, would need to be supported. Their dad isn't working, so they would, the chance of her getting better and being able to care for her kids as opposed to them going back on welfare or staying on welfare, and all of that led to it being worth trying again.
What if she was the Sunday school superintendent?
Well, the pastor's wife.
Mm. No, he's
divorced at this point. That was the pastor's wife. Well, I think it points out issues of conflict, certainly, that would happen in a congregation. Before I tell you what happened to the case, any final comment, Dan, or anybody else need to?
I do want to say we had hoped to be able to spend a little bit of time talking about what are the learnings of this. And one of the clear ones, I think, that why we did this way is just how you see a case depends on where you're sitting. Yes. And one of the reasons we do ethics like this here is so that when we find ourselves in the crunch, we've already been able to think through some things beforehand. You know, and I mean, I really empathize with the folks who found themselves in the family group, because that would be, I mean, how could you think otherwise? And yet, I know for myself, I would want to talk this over with my family ahead of time, because for me, the justice issue is just so critical in a world where the cost of this pancreas transplant would pay for inoculating the children of Nicaragua. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a real important faith issue for me, as well as ethical. But unless you talk it through ahead of time with people, you can't expect families to operate otherwise. And so that was part of what we wanted, and also to see how legislatures have to think about things. Now, we had a particularly cynical legislature. Frankly, being from Minnesota, I was just appalled that they would act that way.
Well, the fact is, I heard several legislative people saying, you mean we've just heard Barbara in testimony? That makes a difference to see Barbara, which is why I wanted to role play it. We tried, how can we do this without having the real Barbara sit here, who I've met in a bioethics class. She came to our class while she's awaiting this third transplant. And I'll tell you, this was clergy, doctors, nurses, and social workers. It was amazing what we had to talk about while she was there. And then she left, and we could talk, but nobody said, well, you know, she probably shouldn't get it, because here she was, a live, human being. And one of the ethical considerations is how much more willing we are to give and to do for somebody we know and love and see in front of us, versus the others out there, whoever they may be. The reality of the case is Barbara's still waiting for a transplant and is still on kidney dialysis.
I mean, you know, one way of thinking about it, if you change the dynamics a little bit, imagine that Barbara is a homeless person who is, you know, is no longer able to take care of her kids. Would it have made a difference in your decision?
How does the University of Minnesota Hospital move into this? Do they do it regardless of whether the money's there, or do they only do it if the money's there?
Up front, they have to know how it's going to get paid for. They don't have to have the money.
We have to let you go, because that bell means they need more people in the first set.
Please run any.
So, we'll get in trouble unless some of you go up there.